Steve.
What's up, dude?
A Healthy Dose is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by Steve Krause, healthcare partner at Bessemer Venture Partners, and Trevor Price, CEO of Oxygen Partners.
Money talks, but it don't sing and dance and it don't walk.
The guys talk to leaders from various aspects of healthcare and cover personal stories, entrepreneurship, investing, and have a few laughs, many at each other's expense.
Well, we both enjoy the art of the conversation. We both have faces that are made for radio. So
at least eyebrows for me.
Double chin for me.
We get a lot of ones right, but we get a lot of ones wrong.
One of the most interesting conversations I've had in a long time.
If you pardon me, I'd like to say we do okay forever in blue jeans. Baby, tonight.
All right, so Trevor, when we scheduled this, I didn't know how this podcast on digital therapeutics was going to go. Because honestly, hate to call you out, but it's not an area of huge expertise of yours. So I was fascinated to see how interested and engaged you became throughout the conversation today.
You lapped me in this area. I walked in, I was like a neophyte, but then total intellectual curiosity kicked in and I couldn't get enough of it. I'm afraid that I didn't shut up for most of the podcast.
No, you were great because like probably most of our listeners have heard about this idea of digital therapeutics. This is the idea that a drug plus some kind of digital intervention, whether it be a video game or an AR, VR, augmented reality experience is better than drug alone or game alone. So it's kind of 1 + 1 = 3, but it's an area that's pretty new for healthcare. It's an area of tremendous innovation. Frankly, I don't think a lot of our listeners probably know a ton about it. So I thought you were great. It's an evolving space, quick moving. I think it's the next frontier in digital health, and hope our listeners will enjoy it and learn a lot as you did, Trevor, from this podcast.
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a unique set of conversations for me, and hopefully, you know, people are happy that I asked the stupid questions that a neophyte is supposed to ask in that situation. So I enjoyed it. I appreciate you setting it up, Steve.
All right. Enjoy.
All right. We've got an exciting panel here today. We love doing our panels where we get to talk about broader trends in the industry. And today we're going to talk about digital therapeutics. And I'm really excited to introduce our guest. First is Corey McCann, founder and CEO of Pear Therapeutics. I've actually known Corey for a long time. He's a physician, scientist, entrepreneur, investor, but now leads one of the early pioneering companies in the space. So thanks, Corey, for joining us. And we also have Eddie Martucci, who is the founder and CEO of Achille Interactive Labs, another pioneer. I guess these are the two pioneering companies in this space. So we've got the best and the brightest. And of course, Jeremy Sohn, Global Head of Commercial Digital Medicines at Novartis. So we're going to get the sort of big company perspective today on the podcast. But let me start off. Most of our listeners have heard the term digital therapeutics, but might have very little clue as to what digital therapeutics is. So
it sounds cool.
You're going to say it at all the cocktail parties. Yeah, totally. I was hosting a digital therapeutics podcast. Yeah. But, you know, Corey, Eddie, what the heck is digital therapeutics?
Starting with a simple definition, I think these are pieces of patient-facing software that are intended to treat disease. Full stop.
Treat disease or change behavior that treats disease?
I think this is an open question in the space, and we would assert that they are directly intended to treat disease. So if you look at the path that we've gone down, essentially these are pieces of patient-facing software. They are run through traditional clinical trial paradigms to examine the ability of these pieces of software to treat the disease. They're evaluated and cleared in much the same way that you would think about for a pharmaceutical product or any other medical product, but they just so happen to be pieces of software.
I think that's the biggest evolution here is that digital anything related to medical has this kind of vague, nebulous quality, and we've seen this in other areas. People have used digital, clinical, whatever, to mean anything that's digital that happens to touch a patient and maybe relates to an outcome. I think what you're seeing as being more concrete and boiling up to the top now are approaches like Pear and Achille, where we're saying, no, there's something very specific here, which is when used by a patient, it can treat a disease. It can have a direct therapeutic outcome, a direct clinically meaningful outcome.
So drop down a level though.
Sure.
Like software to treat disease. So what types of software, how does it actually interact with a person, and how does it actually directly, not through a behavior change, but directly alter a disease state?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's lots of different approaches that will emerge. There's a few today. What we do is we try to have direct neurological activation through sensory stimulus. So we embed algorithms that can activate parts of the brain through the exact types of stimulus, both motor and things flashing up on the screen, that are shown purely by engaging with them to activate neural networks and change neural networks that relate to disorders that rely on, for instance, attention.
I need that.
Actually, when I was preparing the podcast notes, I was thinking, wow, Achille, meet Trevor. Attention deficit disorder.
You'll be shocked to know that I get that every single time we describe.
Your trial enrollment just increased by one now.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, N of one is important.
So I'm assuming that could also apply to depression, that it could apply to dementia, to
opioid
Alzheimer's.
Disorder, yeah.
At Achille, we have products that do span the spectrum. We focus on cognitive dysfunction in various disorders, so different types of algorithms to activate different neurological regions. In that way, thinking about this in many ways like a molecule, something that can be pretty highly targeted to a physiological function, in our case, brain networks, that's really how we approach it from the technology level. And that's why we think if we can get the clinical outcomes we've seen, we also want to approach it from the market and the label perspective, treating a disease.
I think this core concept of neuroplasticity driving a clinical effect is one of the things that many of the companies in the space are fishing after. I think to speak specifically to the way that we've approached neuroplasticity, it's via a digital embodiment of cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. The way that that's played out in our product portfolio is in our set of products, Reset and Reset-O. These are basically digital therapeutics that recapitulate a type of CBT which is addiction specific, and just the same way that you can think about a face-to-face therapeutic encounter as directly treating an addiction condition, the digital therapeutic directly treats that addiction condition. But I think what you...
On its own or in conjunction with methadone and Suboxone and other more traditional drugs?
Yes. So actually both. So there are two products, Reset and Reset-O. Yeah. Reset was cleared by the agency in 2017, and it is intended for use as a monotherapy to treat substance use disorder, which is related to alcohol, cannabis, cocaine, and stimulants. Note that I did not mention opiates.
Yeah.
Reset-O is currently under review by the agency. It was designated priority review at the end of 2017, and that is a combination product, which is intended for use in combination with buprenorphine to treat opiate use disorder.
Well, I want to come back to your specific products and talk about what it means to build a digital therapeutics company from everything, from the team you hire, the trials you run, the outcomes you see. Let's talk about reimbursement commercial. But before we go there, how big is this industry right now? I mean, we're talking to two of the leaders. You know, your companies are the most widely talked about in the press, popular press. Like, but how many other are there right now? Like, how do we define the bread box?
I think you might have to draw a line between companies that have gotten to a point where they are clearly way down the path of doing medicine, meaning running large-scale trials, talking to the FDA, have clearly committed there, versus players that are either, you know, aspirational or pretending. You know, I'm not trying to slam a whole startup industry out there, but I think there's just a lot of that. I mean, the problem in the digital field is there's a lot of apps. I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked before about, you know, dozens of thousands.
Bessemer talking about apps?
the dozens of thousands of apps that are on the marketplace for health or that are out there that you can see. And those aren't encroaching into medicine, nor should they. And doctors certainly aren't using those with their patients. In terms of the first class that I mentioned, so companies actually going down the medical path very clearly and not selling product before they've gotten good clinical validation and regulatory, et cetera. We're talking in the range of a dozen or two. A lot of them are small, kind of fledgling efforts. There's many dozens, and I'm sure Corey can attest to this, when I come off panels of companies that are small or have been in the consumer space but are thinking about trying to truly go medicine. But I think we're at this inflection point. 2017 was, I think, a very big year. I mean, sitting around this table, PAIR was cleared. We had positive results from our phase 3 pivotal trial in ADHD. There were a couple other things, Proteus, pill swallow, which is a bit different than what we do.
Right.
But there was a lot.
But still in the category.
Still in the broadest sense.
Yeah.
And I think what that did, those were three really kind of landmark, put a stamp down that said, this is real. This can have impact. And now we're talking about commercial modeling. So I think some of the floodgates, they were bending a year or two ago, and now they're starting to come open. And as companies like ours and others get to market and show that this truly can be a therapeutic in the sense of the way docs use medicine with patients, that's when you'll see now a rush into the space.
Let's talk about, I mean, I think I met with both of you early on and I regret not being shareholders. I say that a lot. But you know, you guys both have, you're not your typical digital health backgrounds, right? I mean, you were with PureTech, you were with MPM and had a deep biotech background. So I think you're both sitting there in your old jobs looking at classic therapeutics, right? Small molecule, biologics, you know, what sort of clicked for you guys that was like, okay, I'm going to create this field of digital therapeutics. Like, what was that moment? Can you talk about it?
I think what you see in the evolution of digital therapeutics is a space that's being pushed by recovering biotech investors and biotech operators. This is a strategy. It's a business model that feels much more like a traditional pharma product than it does like a digital product. So I'll be very candid with you. I don't know how to build a business which is based on monetization of clicks or selling eyeballs on banner ads. That's just not something that I'm able to think about in a terribly articulate way. That said, when I look across the board at companies and at assets which produce medical value, specifically efficacy as assessed on existing approvable endpoints, those tend to be very good returns for biotech investors, and there aren't a lot of big failures for assets that have great data. So I think for me, the sort of one sentence encapsulation of the aha is digital is the asset. And I think just in looking at the entirety of the opportunity space, and this was 5, 6, 7 years ago, I think having that aha, that digital is the asset, that it could produce drug-like efficacy, that it could be taken down a drug-like path and then ultimately receive drug-like reimbursement, you know, that was a series of sequential ahas.
And is the process to go from small molecule compound all the way through to market release, is it $350 to $500 million?
So I think the easy and obvious answer is it depends. But to be a little bit more specific, it seems to be less costly and less time intensive than a traditional biotech development path. And it seems to have a relatively higher probability of success than a traditional biotech development path. That said, it's not quite as fast as just cooking up an app in your basement and pushing it to the app store tonight.
Still costs a lot more money, which is a great barrior for us. I mean, our companies have raised
$70 million, right? Or more.
Yeah, exactly. So it's still something, still a barrier. There's still IP you have to think about, and that's important. But for companies like ours that are trying to streamline and get there, but still with good science, you know, you're talking an order of magnitude or something in that range, less than a drug, but still enough that, you know, you're tech entrepreneur, you know, two-man show is not going to invest $50 million to get something to market.
And Jeremy, you obviously oversee this at Novartis, which is, you know, a big pharma in some ways, right? And oftentimes a buyer of these types of products.
Correct.
How do you see the biotech industry and digital therapeutics playing out?
So, you know, I think, you know, what some of the earlier comments that were made, it's clear that there's a real opportunity to leverage digital as a drug, particularly in specific therapeutic area indications where there's a lot of room for improvement in terms of the current set of therapeutic assets. And so we all know that technology as well as other, even services, have a potential impact on outcomes. And so to the extent that we could leverage these other inputs, we see it as a tremendous opportunity. And so, you know, one of the things that Vaz, our new CEO, has put forward is that we are a science, we are a medicines, we are a data science, and then we are also a technology company. And so we see technology as much as not just part of our operating process, but also part of our asset base.
Yeah, but let me play the person who starts the fight between our panelists. You produce Ritalin, and he has a digital therapeutic that, if he's successful, makes Ritalin less prescribed.
Listen, I think it's a fair comment. So you know,
fight it out.
Let's make this podcast really, really hum.
Can you guys step out of the room?
That's right. If you can see where I'm wrestling right now. You know, I think it's a great question, but honestly, to the extent that we treat a drug as a drug as a drug, I don't care whether it's a pill or it's an injectable or it's a gene therapy or it's an app. From our perspective, if it leads to an outcome, it's better for patients and then it's better for us. And so we see apps as digital therapeutics as much as part of our future asset base as we do traditional pills.
I love that, you know, a lot of people will get hung up on the form factor, right? And there's this massive intellectual or psychological barrier on the form factor. I think that, you know, getting hung up on form factor, that's not where medicine started. And it's not what medicine should be. Medicine is treating a patient. I think what digital enables is a new form factor, which is actually a product, is easily digestible, quote unquote, right? Pun by
and
a
is
patient.
Your guys like you guys is your exit strategy, you know, through acquisitions by big pharma, or is it IPOs, or what's the ultimate liquidity strategy for a digital therapeutic company?
Yeah, we're not building with partnership of dependency. So we're building our business to be able to sell product, to be able to detail medicine.
Do you build the big distributed sales force that big pharma has, you know, been able to kind of own that space?
Yeah, maybe not as big. I think the scale and scope is the question. But being able to do that, being able to get to docs, to get them to the point of prescribing, absolutely. I actually think for the health of digital therapeutics industry, this is not a subset that is going to need to be dependent on pharma. I think there's absolutely enabling partnerships and commercial partnerships that may be early on or may become the norm in the future, who knows. But I think digital therapeutics companies, our philosophy is we talk constantly to pharma, we've done R&D partnerships. We need to develop what that business model means. In some cases of its partnership, awesome, and there's probably dual value there. But we need to have a mindset of being able to build this industry for ourselves as well.
I very much agree. And at the same time, I would say that, you know, we see big pharma still having a major competitive advantage around that. And it's not to say that we want to actually compete, but, you know, that's what we're really good
you
at,
just
right?
Pulled the term sheet back at it.
No, but that's what we're really good at. We're really good at actually commercialization. And we have feet on the ground. Yep. We've got, you know, major commitment to marketing dollars and sales dollars. And we have the trust of physicians and hopefully the trust of patients. And so, and we shouldn't forget that so much of this is dependent on sort of helping doctors and patients understand that this is a drug and getting people comfortable about it. And so actually, as much as there sometimes is tension, I think, in the marketplace around, you know, big bad pharma, reality is we're really good in terms of just education and validating the clinical impact of the products that we put forward into the marketplace.
I think you're hearing a push toward optionality, which is something that you always want to hear from an entrepreneur. At the same time, I think pharma is incredibly well positioned to be able to execute on the commercial mandate here. So again, if at its simplest level, digital is the asset, pharma happens to be really good at selling assets with best-in-class efficacy labels. And when you look at what has worked and what hasn't worked in patient-facing digital, I think it's become very clear that payer-driven efforts, generally speaking, lack buy-in on the clinician side. And clinician-facing efforts, generally speaking, lack payment. So really, in order to float the boat from a biopharma perspective, this is a traditional two-part sale. Payers pay, physicians prescribe. And I think there's one group in the healthcare landscape that's really good at that, and it's not digital, it's pharma.
But let me ask one question, say, on distribution. How hard is it going to be to convince this generation of doctors to prescribe a different form factor?
I think as we roll this out, the messaging has to be simple. And I think the messaging has to be focused on efficacy. So I'm a firm believer that if this is a digital widget which has a convenience effect, I think you're going to really struggle to get to scale. I think it's going to be really hard to get clinicians to push that into their patient population. If, on the other hand, you're able to come to a clinician with a set of clinical superiority claims, i.e., patients not receiving this product are not receiving standard of care. Mm-hmm. I think that is the holy grail of healthcare promotion, and that is really, I think, what it's going to take to get to scale here. So, you know, I think if you phrase things in terms of this is a package that begets efficacy, it doesn't have to be a piece of software, it doesn't have to be a pill, it could be one or the other, it could be both. But again, this is an efficacy story, and I think if there's one thing that clinicians understand, it's efficacy. And it's even better if it's efficacy that's been assessed by an existing approvable endpoint and if the FDA has blessed those statements around efficacy.
So, Corey, you're the closest to having that, or you maybe even do have it with your Reset product. Is that right?
That's right.
And do you actually have the label now? That
we do.
You do. And so,
we do.
And that, do you feel like the data there is best in class?
We do. We feel like there's a very compelling pivotal study that's associated with the label. And again, when we think about what good looks like, these are labels which are indicated to treat disease. So in the case of Reset, that is to treat substance use disorder, which is not a health and wellness condition, but is a disease. And we have a set of claims to enhance efficacy. And what efficacy means in the case of Reset is abstinence and it also means retention in treatment. And when you start to look at the way that the clinical trial was set up, patients were randomized to receive either best of breed face-to-face therapy or what is partial clinical replacement, so the digital therapeutic with a minimal amount of physician-patient interaction.
And just not like, digital therapeutic alone?
Not in this particular case, not digital therapeutic alone, but it was a partial replacement scenario would be the term of art here. And just like a drug study, the primary endpoint in the study was abstinence as assessed by twice weekly urine drug screen. So we didn't invent any sort of clinical endpoints here. And we saw a very statistically and clinically significant delta between the two treatment groups to the tune of about a 2x enhancement of rates of abstinence at the end of the study for the digital therapeutic group versus the face-to-face therapy group. I would also say that the face-to-face therapy that the patients received in this study was best of breed. So there are very few patients in the wild that receive the quality of care that the control arm received here. So we're talking about big clinical deltas. We're talking about communicating those types of big clinical deltas. And I firmly believe that clinicians will receive that type of clinical data
positively.
And is
your label in that case first-line therapy? I mean, I'm probably using a drug term, so apologize if I am. But is it essentially, you know, RESET is approved for first-line therapy by clinicians when they decide it's the right
thing? The quick aside is we love that you're using a drug term.
Okay.
That's exactly where we should be going, because as Jeremy said and Corey said, I mean, this is, they're all therapeutics, right? So it totally makes sense.
Right. So yes, but I think when you are a first-line therapy, it's often not stated that you're a first-line therapy, but this is not phrased in the context of any sort of a treatment failure. So
it's not that you have to fail treatment first to get RESET. So now the challenge is, and we'll get there, I assume, let's talk about reimbursement, but now the challenge is...
Before we do that, I want to just stay here for a second. And I'm somewhat hesitant to ask this question because I, being someone who's a recipient of Novartis's products in the Ritalin space and also enjoys my dirty martinis, I look at both ADD and substance abuse from a consumer's perspective, not from a diagnosis code perspective. And both areas are amorphous at best in diagnosis, right? There's a lot of people who say they have ADD but were never diagnosed, and a lot of people who are diagnosed who don't seem that different from people who are not diagnosed. And the gray area between substance abuse and recreational use is also hard to clearly define. So do digital therapeutics work primarily today in clinical areas that are hard to have a definitive diagnosis in?
I would completely push back on that. I think when you look across our portfolio, we've moved toward existing clinical conditions, and our model is just like a pharma model based on high acuity conditions. So I think across our portfolio, substance use disorder is probably, quote unquote, the mildest of the conditions that we treat. Our products thereafter target things like opiate use disorder, schizophrenia, and I could sort of work down the portfolio. Sure. But these are not sort of squishy conditions.
Okay.
We have very deliberately run from anything that has a whiff of health and wellness. We are, just like a pharma company, directed toward highly acute conditions. And we don't make up these conditions. These are all conditions that the clinician already understands.
Behavioral health conditions, though.
Not entirely behavioral health conditions. Obviously,
schizophrenia, I think, still falls under that spectrum.
Still falls under that spectrum. I think the full pun intended low-hanging fruit lies in behavioral health because this neuroplasticity effect is a ready therapeutic lever. And it also so happens that drug development here is really hard, and so there's nothing in the pipe. Yeah. So this is where you start, but this is not where you end.
I actually think what's fair, and Corey like kind of tangentially hit it with that last sentence, is these subjectively diagnosed disorders, and there's clearly room for a lot of improvement in the diagnosis, but in mental health, neuropsychiatry, it happens, and it might be the subjective nature of the diagnosis or the heterogeneity might be diagnostic of the fact that, you know, we don't understand the disorder as well as we wish we did. But in any case, those disorders do happen to have large unmet patient needs. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of, you know, our programs go after some of those areas. They are still sort of gold standard diagnosed conditions. They're absolutely conditions that are covered, you know, by insurers. So that's where we're going. But
yeah. These questions are coming from an ADD martini-liker who's also father is a psychiatrist.
Sure.
And stepmother is a child psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So I'm not disputing the science around psychiatry at all. I just find that the diagnosis of these particular conditions, to me, it's less scientific and more judgmental.
It's behavioral observation in many ways.
Fair.
But I think, again, it ties to traditional medicine has had a little bit of a lower hit rate there. And it might be because of sort of the understanding of the disease.
Yeah.
But in our types of platforms, I mean, to go exactly where Corey is going, we also have an application. It's an earlier stage that's targeting cognitive dysfunction, which you can measure objectively. And there's a gold standard accepted way in multiple sclerosis. So this is a neurodegenerative disorder. You can diagnose it. You can also diagnose the cognitive dysfunction, both subjectively and objectively. And we can target that too. So I think it really depends on the disorder. There are huge needs in those subjective disorders. And that's at least one thing that brought us into that area.
Yeah, I think Eddie hit on an important point here, which is that in some respects, your question is talking about certain indications where we don't understand the disease very well, or we don't actually have really good diagnostic tools. And so, you know, one of the things clearly that the industry is doing broadly, and that's, you know, research is doing broadly, is just trying to actually find better ways of measuring those diseases and quantifying and qualifying those diseases. I don't call that digital therapeutics. We call that leveraging technology and our other mechanisms to identify better primary or secondary endpoints. In some cases, it may be, you know, some of the work that Achilles done around just measuring, using technology as a mechanism to better hone in on objective measures. But that'll then come back and allow, you know, people in your situation to say, yes, you know, more definitively, we can say this is a representation of ADHD, as an example. And then that then allows us to actually then use a range of therapeutic options, one of which may be digital therapeutics to treat.
I think just to provide a quick data point around objectivity, in our pivotal study, again, in substance use disorder, the endpoint was based on urinalysis. So one of the great things about addiction conditions from a clinical development perspective is that you have an incredibly articulate biomarker.
Yes.
The primary endpoint is based on urine drug screen with a readout of were you using or were you not using.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in mental health, that's probably about as black and white of a read as you can possibly get.
Does a digital therapeutic solve a physiological problem, or is it a training mechanism? Meaning, are you changing a physiological makeup of someone's brain, or are you training it to do something different?
So I'm a recovering neuroscientist, and I would argue that they're exactly the same thing. So this is, you know, I think one of the primary levers here is a neuroplasticity effect. And what these products are able to do is physically rewire the brain. With that physical rewiring comes neurochemical changes as well. And so this is the semantic issue around the fact that you can't really parse out these two things.
So I want to actually go through all the steps that it takes to develop a digital therapeutic for our listeners. When you guys started, none of this shit had been done before, right? So let's walk through, like, literally, you know, starting a company. And let's do it sort of rapid fire. Got to start a company. Like, you got to build a team. Like, what does a digital therapeutics team look like different from your biotech days are different from Novartis, the team in Novartis? Like, how did you build the team? What were you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, we wanted a mix of everything that that type of therapeutic needs. And that's actually the biggest point we said all the time was, what's the user experience of our medicine? That type of lexicon had no relevance a couple years ago. For us, the user experience of our
medicine. Right, it's not like taking pill, put in your mouth.
Yeah,
right.
It's not the coding
it's not,
of the
it's
pill.
It's not pill color, yeah. That's for sure.
The user experience, it's deep, right? So we actually have a team that spans, and we started this very early on. Actually, my third hire was the executive creative director from Lucasfilm for the entire Star Wars media franchise. But that's what's needed for that form factor of medicine. We want deep engagement. We need to render our sensory stimulus through something that's gonna deeply engage someone.
What's the staff ratio between, I'm assuming it's not sales and marketing that much, but between clinical and software engineering, or clinical product and software engineering, and how does that differ from a traditional
It's a total red herring for us, but we like to say that we're a fully integrated digital therapeutics company. That means nothing, but at the same time,
sounds
really cool. and we're prepared to sell it to the street. what it means that we've set up is a set of people that, as Eddie mentioned, are able to discover these new products. And in a research setting, think about the ways that people, and for that matter, patients, interact with digital products. We then have a group that goes from a hit to a lead, so refinement of the products. We have a group that has created the entirety of our code base in a GMP-compatible way. So you can think of, in the same way that you create a drug, everything that we do is GMP. So there's a quality group, there's a regulatory group. There's then a group that takes that product, runs it through clinical studies. There's a group that then takes those clinical studies and conducts the regulatory filings. And then there's a group that speaks to value. For us, it's everything but boots on the street. And that's, again, I think where pharma really plugs into this model quite nicely.
We're pretty close to balanced at the Achille team. We have a whole crew of software engineers, front-end designers, user experience people. We have a whole crew of, as Corey said, clinical, science, medical, regulatory. And I think you need it all, which makes it a little bit of a bigger undertaking, right? If you're building a biotech company, you don't need to have that other component.
Yeah, can I stop you for 1 second?
Yeah,
though? Because I just want, what I'm hearing, I've never used Achille.
Sure.
Digital therapeutic, but what I'm hearing is it's a interactive media experience.
Correct.
So if Rockstar Games hired child psychiatrists and decided to design that game, because most people say video games actually exacerbate ADD, and what you're saying is if done a different way, you can create an interactive environment and engage people, and almost, you know, people get addicted to video games, and so you have an engagement mechanism that people will use, and it actually...
Combination drug right there.
Addiction video game. No, I mean, it's an astute point, right? And actually, zoom out even one step further. In our case, anything sensory activates the brain, right? It's how we live as humans. It's how we operate. Video games have deep engagement. They also have a whole lot of sensory barrage going on to the brain. And there's actually some interesting studies. One of our co-founding scientists had done work on how action video games, not very dramatically, but in a very modest way, seemed to actually activate attentional networks, right? It wasn't enough to be therapeutic, but there was something you could measure there.
Sorry, is that because the kid who's playing it is like hyper-focused on the game?
No, it's not the hyper-focus. It actually has to do with the direct combination of the various stimuli. So there's little bits of things that maybe every once in a while in sensory stimulus happen to converge in this perfect storm and activate the brain that you want it to. But 99.999% of any visual experience out there today is kind of non-predictively, randomly targeting different parts of the brain. What we did is license in an algorithm that was actually developed for about a decade at UCSF. This is our first product, our ADHD product. We leveraged an algorithm there that deploys sensory stimulus in a very specific way. So you're using a touchscreen tablet, an iPad, the child product as you're driving, you know, down a river with an alien and you're catching stuff. So in the moment, patients forget they're taking medicine, right? They're playing a game. But every second of that experience is actually being tailored by the algorithm, which has underlying IP. So in that way, it's actually not dissimilar from how you might think about a molecule also, right? You have a specific molecular scaffold, which maybe looks like a lot of other stuff, but this specific molecular scaffold, which you can get IP on, which you can tailor, protect, and deliver the way you want, can activate physiology in a certain way. We can do the same thing with experiences. Has the world figured out how to do this at scale yet? I'm not so sure, but I think companies like ours are figuring out how to do it.
My job is, by the way, you're no dummy. You could be like a biotech investor. Look at your questions over here. It's amazing. All right. You're going to see Oxyon start going to be like a biotech search fund pretty soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go back to recruiting team.
Yeah, here you go. All right. We touched on team. Next step, I think, would be IP. And one of the things that I think is really interesting, I imagine, for you guys is breakthrough pioneers, and maybe even for big pharma, which is pretty good at, you know, identifying IP and locking it up, is like, was this just a total, you know, green space and you guys just went around grabbing IP where you could? Like, tell me about that process early on.
I mentioned it a bit earlier, but there's IP out there to be had. It is not the easiest. It's not composition of matter IP. And a lot of people think that we would have your traditional medical device hardware IP, which is also easier, but we don't do that. We want our treatment, our digital therapeutic, to be software-based and be rendered on any broad array of tablets and phones. So we go after algorithm IP. Both algorithm as well as what the consumer world does, which is the interface itself.
And,
so we kind of have two prongs.
Technically,
approach.
Method of use paths.
There's method of use on the algorithms. Yep. Okay. Exactly. And then there's
software systems.
Yeah.
As well.
Software, computer implemented systems. So there's a few. There's systems, methods, and then interface IP. And interface is more what your Apples and Samsungs do. The interface IP is decently easy. The first two, the computer implemented systems and the algorithm method of use IP, those are not easy. There are cases that are still hung up at USPTO figuring it out. We've been able to push a few through. I think there's
Do you both have granted patents?
We've been quite aggressive on the IP side. And again, the sweet spot for us is really around drug software combinations. So all of the ways in which one thinks about digital therapeutics as interacting with a drug.
So software plus drug is better than plus one equals three.
That's the space that we've really tried to carve out. We've been quite aggressive from an intellectual property space there.
I did. I was thinking that's music to Novartis's ears, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, we're encouraged by the fact that there's IP. I would say that quite candidly, we're also not 100% relying on our business case being IP-driven. We like the fact that our partners are taking a very strong and appropriate IP strategy. At the same time, again, we believe that best-in-class efficacy, being able to tailor it with our drugs, understanding, again, sort of the marketplace, some of the conversation that we had earlier, is going to allow us to compete in a more differentiated way.
And are you guys investing in this space? Are you deploying capital from within Novartis into either internally into building labs or taking equity positions in these companies?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say a lot about that, but the answer to that is yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So you're not standing on the sidelines waiting to see whether these guys succeed or fail?
No, you know, again, we want what's best for our patients. And I think there's enough evidence right now that great companies like, you know, Pear and Achille and others have a tremendous potential to improve the outcomes of patients in new and exciting ways. And so we shouldn't just rely on the traditional, you know, set of therapeutic options.
Can I ask on the IP question, because you make an interesting point, you both nod, I think, that IP alone is not, you know, a lot of pharma value is tied up in IP and patent protection, right? It sounds like it's a little less important here, and I'm wondering how that affects how you think about the business. Does that mean you're going to have less patent life? Does that mean you're going to have more competitors coming? Like, how do you think about IP as part of your portfolio and how important it is?
I think the jury's still out as to whether it's less important here. So I think that would just be the first thing that I would step in on.
Okay.
I think, as we've acknowledged, this is a new thing, and we're in an entirely new space here. And what that means to me is that we need to do all of the things well. So this cannot be just an IP play. It has to be an IP play that gets approved and has some means of regulatory exclusivity, that clinicians love, that's easy to use, that makes patients much better. You have to do all the things here if you want to do something new. That's the way that we've approached things. And, you know, you asked a couple of minutes ago now, you know, how do you start this thing? And, you know, for us, it's really been a top-down approach to think about what good looks like for a biotech or a specialty pharma company, and then go and do all those things. You know, none of the strategy is in any way novel. It's just that it's never been done for a digital product before.
So now, but let's get to the core of the issue, because you guys are clearly spending a lot of money building these teams. And with a Ritalin pill or, you know, with a Suboxone pill, you know how much you get paid for each pill. So how's the revenue and reimbursement model? Like, have you guys figured out how you can make equivalent money treating ADD or addiction as you would if you were producing manufacturing pills?
Yeah, I think you'll see the reimbursement story evolve quite rapidly on the Pear side in 2018. It's obviously early days, but when
is this, sorry to interrupt, but is this you go to CMS first? Is this a traditional CMS first and then the commercial payers follow? Or is this a go to commercial payers and fight a...
I think it's commercial payers first, just from a traction perspective. But I think you'll see a lot of exciting developments there.
And sorry, just to let me push, is that because they're more innovative? Is that because their population is the right age population for this?
It's because they make decisions faster, very simply.
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming you guys have some form of multi-user cloud-based strategy. And so in that situation, a payer is reimbursing a subscription cost for someone to enroll in a 12-week or... 18-week program?
That's right. The way that all of our products are architected is that they're access code based. Mm-hmm. So the prescription vector is actually an access code. And any patient...
And they have to be prescribed by a doctor?
It all has to be physician prescription. That's correct.
Corey, have you thought about an initial go-to-market strategy of selling to self-insured employers versus commercial health plans? If you go to Walmart or Comcast or Disney or others, you know, they have direct implications of substance abuse amongst employees. Have you thought about that as an initial go-to-market strategy?
This is a little bit of a personal aside. I would think about Digital Health 1.0 as being built on the thesis that self-insured employer groups will pay for everything. And I think that has been an abject failure. I think from our perspective, when you take three steps back, the thing that works time and time again is get efficacy data, get efficacy claims, make the two-part sale. And when you look across the pharma landscape, assets with best-of-breed efficacy data.
Because you're not disrupting the as-is system.
That is the model. I think there was a lot of hope 5 to 7 years ago that digital would be able to plug into this entirely new model, but healthcare is about existing models. It's not to say that we couldn't sell this through self-insured employer groups. Frankly, we haven't tried, but we're a small company that's resource-constrained, and we're not going to try because we don't see a lot of good data points
there. Jeremy, not to, again, pick on pharma guys, but if these guys prove that they can have a clinically efficacious effect on ADD for substantially less money than
Ritalin. What does that do to the higher ups? That, you know, when you have a blockbuster drug like that, like what happens inside of Novartis?
You know, it's a great question. I think like any company, let alone a pharma company or a technology company or a services company, you're always looking at your portfolio and you're trying to make sure that your portfolio is competitive. And so either we have to figure out how do we sell our existing drugs better, certainly again into the right places, or we, you know, partner or license with, you know, the best in class drug and continue to expand our product lifecycle.
This is, I think, the third time that you've brought up this competition between digital therapeutics and the pill, yeah. And I'm finally going to take the bait. So, you know, we founded the company starting with the clinical condition and working backward. And so what that means is that for many of these patients, this is about a digital therapeutic that works on top of medication to make the medication more efficacious. And so I think it's actually a corner case where this is going to be an or situation. I think in most cases, this is going to be digital plus a pill. We have some different thoughts about that around the table, but it really depends upon the clinical condition.
Exactly.
So if you look at our schizophrenia product, for example, we don't believe that there's a credible target product profile for getting floridly psychotic patients off of their atypical antipsychotic.
Yes.
This is a digital therapeutic which is based on the ability to enhance their symptomology in combination with the drug.
I get that.
So I think that's just a frame that I'm finally gonna take the bait here again.
No, I'm not a digital therapeutics guy. So to me, it's, I get that you're augmenting traditional pharmaceutical products. I'm saying in a theoretical case where you provide an alternative, what I was trying to get at is, does the digital therapeutic purposely not want to be less expensive because they want to be seen as a true apples-to-apples alternative?
Right. If you have better efficacy, are you going to price more?
I mean, that's a traditional pharma model, right?
Yeah, pricing doesn't really tend to be driven by the form factor. It should be driven, and it's going in the direction of being driven by the clinical effect.
Right. Yeah.
I think actually the disruption piece is on the connection with the patient and the data you get out of it. So the big thing I task my team with, especially our innovation team, is to think about what would it mean if people loved your pill and your medicine as much as you loved your iPhone? What does that enable? I think price is actually not the thing that's going to evolve it. I actually think it's going to be that, the connection with the patient, the data you get out of it, and the way we think about over
assuming
time.
Assuming you also don't have side effects.
Yeah,
like, you don't, it's not like someone has anxiety or sleep loss, like when they're taking a stimulant.
We measure side effects. I think Jeremy made a point earlier, really important to measure side effects. We get very few, about tenfold less side effects in our ADHD program, and there are things like headache and frustration. So there's something there, but I think the tolerability profile is very different than traditional medicine.
So, I mean, obviously a new burgeoning field. When you guys sit back now, sort of being the veterans in the field, which sort of says something about where we are given all our age, but what has been more difficult than you thought, and what has gone better than you thought?
I think eliciting behavior change within pharma has been more difficult than we thought. Again, I went into this thinking this was a pretty simple story. Digital is the asset. Digital confers efficacy. Pharma needs assets. Do some deals with us. Yeah, I thought it was pretty simple. And I think there's been a long learning process there. I think on the other hand, the agency and payers have actually been dramatically more receptive than we thought they would have been.
And payers, that's really
we were pleasantly surprised with all of our interactions with FDA to date, so I think that went much more smoothly. I think for me the hard part, I actually look internally at Akili. As a company, we talked a lot about having to resource and invest in two different things, right? Medicine and the kind of user experience, the tech. I don't think it's the investment in those things. It's actually keeping that balance that can be really difficult. So all companies in digital health 1.0, as Corey said, got pulled, and there's a constant pull, and we feel it, toward one of those two sides. You say, no, we're a medicine company, and then you forget and you don't invest in the tech or vice versa.
Yeah.
And I think for us, it is a constant drumbeat where we say we have to uphold and do the best of both of those worlds if our product's going to be successful in the future and if digital medicine's going to be successful. We now keep it as almost like a little bit of a battle scar and a badge of honor where we say we think the fact that we believe we do it well is a competitive advantage, it's a secret sauce, but it is a constant thing that needs attention. When you are a type of company that's bridging two different worlds, you got to keep both of those pieces of your DNA front of mind.
You just triggered something. I think you, Corey, made the point multiple times about not being health and wellness. But the thing that I've seen, and I think Steve would say this, in digital health 1.0, now there is no doctor's prescription, mm-hmm. and it's not a therapeutic, but engagement is horrible.
Sure.
Like, people just don't use these things.
That's right.
I think one of the questions that I will definitely love to watch happen is, does the fact that a doctor prescribed it and it is viewed differently, it's not viewed as an app, it's viewed as a medication.
A therapeutic.
Does that change the engagement rate?
I think it's twofold. We definitely believe that that will have some effect. I mean, I think being part of the medical system and the connected data you can do to enforce that once it's prescribed, I think should see an effect you didn't see in things that are just for wellness. I do think there's also an evolution of product development and how you think about that. We're going over the top and investing in game design in a quality system facility that's fully up to regulations. Not the best thing in the world to recruit for like a hot to trot game engineer come and develop under our medical device quality systems. But we fully invest in a legitimate game studio. And I think where you saw in, again, Digital Health 1.0.
It was slap an app and
it was
with
slap
$5
it on
bucks.
Top, yeah. Slap a couple colors,
yeah.
And you know, it should be good. I think you're seeing an evolution where you got to do the deep engagement to the same degree you do the deep medicine.
I think we have a lot of data suggesting that the degree of clinician involvement scales with the degree of patient involvement. And so these are not simple replacements, set it and forget it. There's a clinician dashboard that keeps the clinician informed. And what we find is that if the clinician is referring to that dashboard and speaking to the patient about the dashboard, that's about the best thing that can possibly happen in the system.
I think we need to remember that in a lot of these, conveniently, a lot of these digital therapeutics are targeting indications where the current drug profile isn't as good, but not great, right? And so the value here, we talked a lot earlier about the fact that we've got best-in-class clinical data, which I think is huge. But I actually think we didn't talk about and emphasize the flip side of it, which is that we have a tremendous unmet need, right? And so the marketplace, whether it's in substance abuse or ADHD, we're significantly ahead of where we were 5 years ago, 20 years ago, et cetera. But we have so much more to do, and this is giving us that opportunity. And so I think this is one of those areas where physicians, payers, patients are eager to have real problems.
To try something new.
Yeah, exactly, to try something new. And in fact, because there are user interface experiences, it's actually has the potential of having a better adherence profile than your traditional drugs. Because I don't have a relationship with my orange pill or my white pill or, you know, or my injection. I might have, as Eddie said, a relationship with my digital therapeutic.
And I'm assuming none of you guys probably would disclose this, but it strikes me, given everything you described, that Alzheimer's would be in some ways one of the most substantial targets for this. There is no traditional pharmaceutical product, I think. You're now able to diagnose Alzheimer's 15 years before its onset. Is Alzheimer's—
Is there potential?
Our ADHD technology, funny enough, began being studied in old adults, actually. And so there's certain cognitive networks that interestingly overlap there at the two ends of this age spectrum. We've done some work in Alzheimer's, including both on the treatment side, but also on the assessment side, trying to get objective metrics through an engaging interface that might be more sensitive than what's out there today. So I agree there's a huge opportunity. I assume you'll see in Alzheimer's and neurodegeneration more broadly, people targeting that eventually. It's a huge space with a huge
need. All right,
need.
You need to go to the airport.
I had a lot more fun with this than I expected.
Okay, so I gotta tell you guys something. I sent him an email and he said, what the fuck is digital therapy? That's what he emailed me. I said, Trevor, trust me, you're gonna like these guys. They're really freaking smart and they're pioneers.
I had a lot of fun, guys. I appreciate
that was
it.
Awesome.
No, thank you guys. Seriously, this was awesome. Great. Really appreciate it. And I'm glad you guys are doing what you're doing. Let the travel be
forever in blue jeans. Thanks for listening to A Healthy Dose. Please subscribe through iTunes, and if you have any suggestions for topics or guests, email the guys at steve@bvp.com or trevor@oxyandpartners.com. We do okay.